The Holy Gospel according to Luke.
Glory to you, O Lord.
Once, while Jesus was standing beside the lake of Gennesaret, and the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God, he saw two boats there at the shore of the lake. The fishermen had gone out of them and were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little way from the shore. Then he sat down and taught the crowds from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we have worked all night long but have caught nothing. Yet, if you say so, I will let down the nets." When they had done this, they caught so many fish that their nets were beginning to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came and filled both boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." For he and all who were with him were amazed at the catch of fish they had taken. And so also were James and John, son of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will be catching people." When they had brought their boats to shore, they left everything and followed him. The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Between 1865 and 1950, it is estimated that over 6,500 black women, men, and children were victims of mob lynching in the United States. On this day, February 6, 1902, in Nicholasville, Kentucky, Thomas Brown, 19 years old, was taken from Belize by a mob of 200 white men and hung from a tree in front of the county courthouse. He had been arrested for an alleged assault against a white woman, though never tried. During this period of our history, roughly a quarter of these mob lynchings involved suspicion of inappropriate behavior between a black man and a white woman, whereas sexual assaults against black women were often ignored by law enforcement and the white press. These mobs often involved prominent members of the white community, sometimes even the police, and there was a social contract amongst them to keep their identities hidden from investigators to ensure that no one be held accountable. Thomas Brown's murderers were never arrested. There was no investigation. In fact, if you try to learn more about Thomas Brown, you will find no more than a single paragraph from an old Kentucky newspaper, the author giving no sympathy to Brown. And even this is more than many hundreds of unidentified black lives taken during this period. Women, men, and children publicly tortured, murdered, and bodies mutilated, often for public spectacle to a cheering crowd. I have often railed against formally taking part in Black History Month because it is a form of corporate tokenism. One month out of the year, we talk about people like Thomas Brown, victims of violent racial injustice, and also about great figures like Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, and the contributions of great civil rights leaders and political voices, artists, inventors, and poets, Booker T. Washington, Langston Hughes, Gladys West, the Virginia farm girl who invented GPS technology, Ruby Sales, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, James Brown, Toni Morrison, Angela Davis. The rest of the year, we tend to forget them. And when I was piecing together today's service, it dawned on me that as hypocritical as it may be to single out one month of the year to lift up black voices, it is worse to never talk about them. So here we are, choosing to devote one month out of the year for black lives in the hope that it will help condition us to incorporate these stories and these voices into our daily spiritual lives. I saw a meme earlier this week. It was a cartoon depicting one white child walking with a black child. The white child says to the black child, "It's your month. And the black child replies, "No, it's your month. I'm black all year round." I know a lot of us are tired. I'm tired. I'm tired of the continued patterns of injustice in our world, in our systems, in our government, and in our culture. I'm tired of seeing efforts towards truth and reconciliation thwarted by opportunistic politicians and by egomaniacal radio personalities. I'm tired of seeing fear win. I'm exhausted by our cultural terror of scarcity. If we give more to these, we have to take away from ourselves. There's just not enough food or money or jobs or education or basic civil rights to go around. I'm tired of having and listening to arguments to convince stubborn minds that without justice for all, there is no justice for any, that we have no reason to fear the truth, that there are worse things than being inconvenienced or being made uncomfortable. And I'm tired of having to repeatedly face the shortcomings of my own perspective, because no matter how many books I read or rallies I attend, I will never actually know what it feels like to be black. I am tired. I am tired of working and pulling up empty nets. And my tiredness is absolutely nothing, because even my exhaustion is a privilege. Not like Thomas Brown. Not like countless black lives across America since 1619, when the African slave trade began in Virginia. I have a choice to care. I have the power to look away and to wash off my nets and call it a day. In our reading from Isaiah, we hear God telling the prophet to continue in his work, even though the people will remain unmoved. Make the mind of this people dull and stop their ears and shut their eyes so that they may not look with their eyes and listen with their ears or comprehend with their minds and turn and be healed. The prophet asks, "How long, O Lord?" And God replies, "Until cities lie waste without inhabitant and houses without people and the land is utterly desolate, until the Lord sends everyone far away and vast is the emptiness in the midst of our land." God comes to the prophet in a vision, in the form of a king overlooking the world from above. And normally, I would push against getting locked into the idea of God being a big king in the sky looking down, but it is one of the many forms God appears as to prophets throughout Scripture. And here in this kingly vision serves both to enforce the authority of the prophet's mission and to provide a larger context. God can see the bigger picture, even if the prophet cannot. The prophet must continue to work, to tell the truth, to share the visions given to him by God, even with the foreknowledge that the people will reject it. This is our call. We have been shown God's truth in abundance and are daily called to mission in the world on behalf of the poor, the ignorant, the captive, and the oppressed. And we are also assured that the world will reject it. Not us, mind you. The world doesn't reject us when it clings to fear and hatred. The world rejects God's promise. Nonetheless, we are called to fight a battle with the knowledge that we cannot win. This is a dismal revelation to Isaiah, and yet it is also a sort of liberation. There is an enormous relief of pressure when you know the odds are against you, and you are better postured to learn from each defeat. As anyone can tell you, we learn much more from mistakes than from winning. And to add a little sweetness, every little step forward, every small victory feels that much more spectacular. If you have ever played for a team with a poor record, come on in.
Sorry, I...
If you have ever played for a team with a poor record or have been a fan of an underdog, you know this feeling. This is why fans of the New York Yankees are so boring. In our journey through the Gospel of Luke, we've heard Jesus' declaration of his identity and his purpose to serve the poor, the ignorant, the captive, and the oppressed. We've listened to how he has already been rejected by his own people in Nazareth. We've read that Jesus taught, but not yet the contents of his teaching. Today, we witness the promise of abundance, fulfilled by obedience to action, and are called to share the good news of this abundance. Jesus sees the fishermen exhausted and sends them back out into the deep waters to the place of untapped resources. Simon's words reflect his doubts and reluctance, but his obedience, even in his tiredness, is immediate. as is the catch. The fishermen represent the state of the Jewish people at this time. They have been burdened for centuries by military, legal, and financial oppression. Their central government has little to no actual power, and the people have no real advocate or representation. They have been culturally conditioned to accept defeat and pay little heed to hope. But this catch, these nets so full of fish that they nearly sink two boats, in the presence of witnesses who will all be fed by this miracle, this catch signifies the arrival of the Messiah, a pivot piece in the history of God's people, because this miracle is the form of the first calling of prophets to mission. Christ has arrived. The days of perpetual losing are over, and we are called to play a part in it. The new call to be catchers of people, to share in the abundance and complete provision with the community, demands only our obedience to try again, even when all of our efforts have failed and we are tired. Like the fishermen, we are invited, when we feel we are defeated, to go back out into the deeper waters, the place of untapped resources. Get creative, be bold, do not hesitate to be afraid or mess up, because even if we do, it won't matter, because tomorrow is another day. And we'll get to try again. However, Paul's letter to the Corinthians accompanies our readings this morning, and I'm glad that we have his voice alongside these passages to help bring us back to earth a little bit. Because you see, you and I are not the fishermen in this story, at least not in the analogy I set up with racial violence in America. By our heritage, though not our actions, we play a part as the persecutor. By our continued role of wearing the skin of privilege, we play the part in racial injustices and inequalities of our time, which isn't to say that God can't also use us to catch a few fish or people. To be honest, folks, I don't fully understand Jesus's metaphor with the fish. You see, though Paul understood the irony of his own role, he was called to be one of the most, if not the most, influential figures in the founding of the Christian church. And that was not his beginning, though. I've always felt Paul was being a bit dramatic, calling himself the greatest among sinners and the least worthy, but that is from the perspective of seeing his legacy. Paul started as a murderer. He was a promising young man once upon a time, a captain of the status quo, eager to impress his peers and superiors with his ruthlessness. It was once his mission to destroy the church. He hunted and betrayed Jewish followers of Christ, his own people, brothers, sisters, and neighbors. He was not redeemed by any power of his own and by his own pen. It was by grace and grace alone that his life was transformed and was made into an instrument for God's mission on earth. Even so, he remained in a seat of privilege. He would travel the world and be persecuted and imprisoned. He would know hunger and terror, and at any time, he could have walked away. He could have chosen disobedience. He would have been welcomed back into the circles that he had left and led a comfortable life, but it would not have been an abundant life, for all of the comfort would have come at the expense of those that he had been called to love and betrayed. For the poor, he was called to clothe and feed. For the ignorant, he was called to teach. For the sick and the captive and the oppressed and the tired. Our call to mission, to share in the abundance of God's grace, requires that we obey, not in innocence or understanding or perfection, but in honesty. Like Simon, we have a voice to say, "I've already tried and failed," so long as we go back out and try again. The example of Isaiah not only gives us permission to accept a degree of failure, but to embrace it as a way of life. And by Paul's example, to wear our shortcomings, much like a coat of arms or tattoos, a map of our journey. Thomas Brown was a child of God. We can assume by his age he was either the child or at least the grandchild of slaves. He would have grown up in extreme poverty with little to no education, little to no access to proper health care. He would have witnessed white terror at the hands of the KKK. He may have had family or himself have been incarcerated for a crime, real, slight, or imaginary, all at the age of 19. We can be assured that Thomas Brown did not lead a perfect life. He may or may not have committed the crime the mob used to justify his murder. We can also be assured that Jesus came on earth and lived and healed and taught and died for Thomas Brown. He was beloved. James Cone, the father of black theology, wrote, "Racism is a complete denial of the incarnation and thus of Christianity. Any talk about God that fails to make God's liberation of the oppressed its starting point is not Christian. The cross," he declares, "is a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system with the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, that the last shall be first and the first shall be last." People of God, we have been called. Silence is not an option. Defeat is not a barrier. Our Creator made us for togetherness. Only greed and pride and fear can drive us apart. So I challenge you today, as I challenge myself, when you are tired and ready to give up, go out into deeper waters and cast your nets again. God's resources are limitless. Even the youth grow tired and weary, and the young will stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength.